Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Good evening, and now for some more movies, or in fact a movie about a man. Richard Feynman in conversation with himself. Hello, I'm Robin Williams. So why listen once more to this legend of Caltech, Los Alamos and the topless bar? Why? To note the last couple of nights of the play QED, starring Henry Zepps at the Ensemble Theatre in Sydney, with other dates, we hope, elsewhere in Australia. It's all about a man with the pithiest down-to-earth approach to everything, especially education. He's the most extraordinary person you're likely to hear on those subjects. Dick Feynman died long ago, but not before he was recorded on film and sound tape. This is from the science show I broadcast way back, in which Dr. Feynman, Nobel laureate, talks in conversation to himself.
All the kids were playing in a field, and one kid said to me, see that bird? What kind of a bird is that? And I said, I haven't the slightest idea what kind of a bird it is. He says, it's a brown-throated thrush or something. He says, your father doesn't tell you anything. But it was the opposite. My father had taught me, looking at a bird, he says, do you know what that is? It's a brown-throated thrush. But in Portuguese, it's a hontarapero. In Italian, a chuterapiquita. He says, in Chinese, it's a chungmongtao. In Japanese, a patata tokodacha, etc. He says, now they've know all the languages you want to know what the name of that bird is. And when you're finished with all that, he says, you'll know absolutely nothing whatever about the bird. You only know about humans in different places and what they call the bird. Now, he says, let's look at the bird and what it's doing. He had taught me to notice things, and one day when I was playing with what we call an express wagon, which is a little wagon which has a railing around it for children to play with that they can pull around, it had a ball in it. I remember this, it had a ball in it. And I pulled the wagon, and I noticed something about the way the ball moved. So I went to my father, and I said, say, Pop, I noticed something. When I pull the wagon, the ball rolls to the back of the wagon. It rushes to the back of the wagon. And when I'm pulling along and I suddenly stop, the ball rolls to the front of the wagon. I said, why is that? And he said, that, he says, nobody knows. He said, the general principle is that things that are moving try to keep on moving. And things that are standing still tend to stand still unless you push on them hard. And he says, this tendency is called inertia, but nobody knows why it's true. Now, that's a deep understanding. He doesn't give me a name. He knew the difference between knowing the name of something and knowing something, which I learned very, very early. He went on to say, if you look close, you'll find the ball does not rush to the back of the wagon, but it's the back of the wagon that you're pulling against the ball, that the ball stands still, or as a matter of fact, from the friction, starts to move forward, really, and doesn't move back. So I ran back to the little wagon and set the ball up again and pulled the wagon from under it, and looking sideways and seeing indeed he was right, the ball never moved backwards in the wagon when I pulled the wagon forward. It moved backward relative to the wagon, but relative to the sidewalk, it was moved forward a little bit. It's just the wagon caught up with it. So that's the way I was educated by my father. With no pressure, just lovely, interesting discussion. I have a friend who's an artist and has sometimes taken a view which I don't agree with very well. He'll hold up a flower and say, look how beautiful it is, and I'll agree. And he says, you see, as I as an artist can see how beautiful this is, but you as a scientist, oh, take this all apart and it becomes dull. And I think that he's kind of nutty. First of all, the beauty that he sees is available to other people and to me too. I believe, although I may not be quite as refined as aesthetically as he is, that I can appreciate the beauty of a flower. At the same time, I see much more about the flower than he sees. I could imagine the cells in there, the complicated actions inside, which also have a beauty. I mean, it's not just beauty at this dimension of 1 centimeter. There's also beauty at a smaller dimensions. The inner structure, also the processes, the fact that the colors and the flower evolved in order to attract insects to pollinate it is interesting. It means that insects can see the color. It adds a question. Does this aesthetic sense also exist in the lower forms? Why is it aesthetic? All kinds of interesting questions which the science knowledge only adds to the excitement, the mystery, and the awe of a flower. It only adds. I don't understand how it subtracts.
As a junior physicist, Richard Feynman was asked to go to Los Alamos to join the Manhattan Project to build the bomb. It was an enormous step.
It was a completely different kind of a thing. It would mean that I would have to stop the research in what I was doing, which is my life's desire to take time off to do this, which I felt I should do in order to protect civilization, if you want. Okay? So that was what I had to debate with myself. My first reaction, I didn't want to get interrupted in my normal work. There was also the problem, of course, of any moral thing involving war, I didn't have much to do with, but it kind of scared me when I realized what the weapon would be. Since it might be possible, there was nothing that I knew that indicated that if we could do it, they couldn't do it, and therefore it was very important to try to cooperate. With regard to moral questions, I do have something I would like to say about it, because the original reason to start the project, which I had, which was that the Germans were in danger, started me off on a process of action, which was to try to develop this first system in Princeton, then at Los Alamos, to try to make the bomb work. All kinds of attempts to redesign, to make it a worse bomb. And with any project like that, you continue to work trying to get success, having decided to do it. But what I did immorally, I would say, was not to remember the reason that I said I was doing it. So that when the reason changed, which was that Germany was defeated, not the single thought came to my mind at all about that. That meant now that I have to reconsider why I'm continuing to do this. I simply didn't think, okay? Only reaction I remember, perhaps I was blinded by my own reaction, it was a very considerable elation and excitement. And there was parties and people got drunk and a tremendously interesting contrast of what was going on in Los Alamos at the same time as what was going on in Hiroshima. I was involved with this happy thing and also drinking, sitting on the bonnet of a Jeep and playing drums and excitement running all over Los Alamos at the same time as the people were dying and struggling in Hiroshima. I had a very strong reaction after the war of a peculiar nature. It may be from just the bomb itself, and it may be for some other psychological reasons. I had just lost my wife or something. But I remember being in New York with my mother in a restaurant right after, immediately, and thinking about New York. And I knew how big the bomb in Hiroshima was, how big an area it covered, and so on. And I realized from where we were, I know, 59th Street, to drop one at 34th Street. And then it would spread all the way out there, and all these people would be killed, and all the things would be killed. And that wasn't only one bomb available, but it was easy to continue to make them. And therefore, that things were sort of doomed, because already it appeared to me, very early, earlier than to others who were more optimistic, that international relations and the way people were behaving was no different than it had ever been before, and that it was just going to go out the same way as any other thing, and I was sure it was going to, therefore, to be used very soon. So I felt very uncomfortable and thought, really believed, that it was silly. I would see people building a bridge, and I would say, they don't understand. I really believed that it was senseless to make anything because it would all be destroyed very soon anyway, that they didn't understand that. And I had this very strange view of any construction that I would see. I would always thought how foolish they are to try to make something. So I was really in a kind of depressive condition. Kind of real good physics work, you do need absolute solid lengths of time. It's when you're putting ideas together, which are vague and hard to remember. Yeah. Get this feeling very much like building those houses of cards, where you're putting together, on each of the cards is shaky. And if you forget one of them, the whole thing collapses again. You don't know how you got there, and you have to build them up again. And if you're interrupted and kind of forget half the idea of how the cards went together, you put this stuff together, it's quite a tower, and it's easy to slip. It needs a lot of concentrating. That is solid time to think. And if you've got a job in administrating anything like that, then you don't have the solid time. So I have invented another myth for myself, that I'm irresponsible. I'm actively irresponsible, I tell everybody. If anybody asks me to be on a committee to take care of admissions, no, I'm irresponsible. I don't give a damn about the students. Of course I give a damn about the students, but I know that somebody else will do it. And I take the view, let George do it. A view which you're not supposed to take, okay? Because then that's not right to do. But I do that because I like to do physics, and I want to see if I can still do it. And so I'm selfish, okay? I want to do my physics. Because I'm not responsible for what other people think I'm able to do. I don't have to be good because they think I'm going to be good. And somehow or other, I could relax about this. And I thought to myself, I haven't done anything important. Well, I'm never going to do anything important. But I used to enjoy physics and mathematical things, and because I used to play with it. But I used to do things for the fun of it. And only that afternoon when I was eating lunch, some kid threw up a plate in the cafeteria, which has a blue medallion on the plate, the Cornell sign. And as he threw up the plate and it came down, it wobbled and the blue thing went around like this. And I wondered, it seemed to me the blue thing went around faster than the wobble, and I wondered what the relation was between the two. See, I was just playing, no importance at all. So I played around with the equations of motion of rotating things, and I found out that if the wobble is small, the blue thing goes around twice as fast as the wobble goes around. And then I tried to figure out if I could see why that was directly from Newton's laws instead of through the complicated equations. And I worked that out for the fun of it. And then I went to Hans Bethe, and I said to him, hey, by the way, I show you something amusing. And I explained this to him. And he said to me, that's very amusing and interesting. He said, but what is the use of it? What? I said, that doesn't make any difference. It hasn't any use. I'm just doing it for the fun of it. And then Bob Wilson, who was the head of the nuclear lab there, had some kind of instinct or something, because it was at the same day or other that he called me in, and he told me that when they hire a professor at a university, it's their responsibility what the professor does, and it's their risk. And if he doesn't do anything or he doesn't accomplish anything, it's not his thing to worry about that. And they're taking the risk to put him in the environment, and I should do whatever I want, amuse myself or whatever I want. So with that double combination, I could relax somehow. I was getting out from some psychological problem. And I relaxed and started to play it, as I said, with the rotation. And this rotation led me to the problem, a similar problem of the rotation of the spin of an electron, according to Dirac's equation. And that just led me back into quantum electrodynamics, which is the problem I've been working on. And I kept continuing now to play with it in the relaxed fashion I had originally done. And everything, it's just like taking a cork out of a bottle. Everything just poured out. I, by the way, in very short order, worked the things out for which I later won the Nobel Prize.
Was it worth the Nobel Prize?
I don't know anything about the Nobel Prize. I don't understand what it's all about or what's worth what. And if the people in the Swedish Academy decide that X, Y, or Z wins the Nobel Prize, then so be it. I won't have anything to do with the Nobel Prize. It's a pain in the neck. I don't like honors. I appreciate it for the work that I did and for people who appreciate it, and I notice that other physicists use my work. I don't need anything else. I don't think there's any sense to anything else. I don't see that it makes any point that someone in the Swedish Academy decides that this work is noble enough to receive a prize. I've already got the prize. The prize is the pleasure of finding the thing out, the kick in the discovery, the observation other people use it. Those are the real things. The honors are unreal to me. I don't believe in honors. It bothers me. Honors bothers me. Honors as epaulets. Honors as uniforms. My papa brought me up this way. I can't stand it. It hurts me. When I was in high school, one of the first honors I got was to be a member of the Arista, which is a group of
kids who got good grades. And everybody wanted to be a member of the Arista. And when I got into the Arista, I discovered that what they did in their meetings was to sit around and to discuss who else was worthy to join this wonderful group that we are. Okay, so we sat around trying to decide who it was who would get to be allowed into this Arista. This kind of thing bothers me psychologically for one or another reason. I don't understand myself. Honors have, from that day to this, always bothered me. I had trouble when I became a member of the National Academy of Science, and I had ultimately to resign because there was another organization, most of whose time was spent in choosing who was illustrious enough to be allowed to join us in our organization, including such questions as, we physicists have to stick together because there's a very good chemist that they're trying to get in and we haven't got enough room for so. What's the matter with chemists? The whole thing was rotten. Because the purpose was mostly to decide who could have this honor. Okay, I don't like honors.
And you're listening to In Conversation with me, Robin Williams, and some thoughts from the great Dr. Richard Feynman on life, living, and being smart.
Imagine that the gods are playing some great game, like chess, let's say a chess game, and you don't know the rules of the game, but you're allowed to look at the board, at least from time to time, and in a little corner, perhaps. And from these observations, you try to figure out what the rules are of the game, what the rules of the pieces moving. So you might discover after a bit, for example, that when there's only one bishop around on the board, that the bishop maintains its color. Later on, you might discover the law for the bishop is it moves on a diagonal, which would explain the law that you understood before, that it maintains its color. And that would be analogous to we discover one law and then later find a deeper understanding of it. Then things can happen. Everything's going good. You got all the laws. It looks very good. And then all of a sudden, some strange phenomenon occurs in some corner. So you begin to investigate that, to look for it. It's castling, something you didn't expect it. We're always, by the way, in a fundamental physics, always trying to investigate those things in which we don't understand the conclusions. We're not trying to check all the time our conclusions. After we've checked them enough, we're okay. The thing that doesn't fit is the thing that's the most interesting, the part that doesn't go according to what you expected. Also, we could have revolutions in physics after you've been noticed that the bishops maintain their color and they go along the diagonals and so on for such a long time, and everybody knows that that's true. Then you suddenly discover one day in some chess game that the bishop doesn't maintain its color. It changes its color. Only later do you discover the new possibility that the bishop is captured and that a pawn went all the way down to the queen's end to produce a new bishop. That can happen, but you didn't know it. And so it's a very analogous to the way our laws are. They sometimes look positive. They keep on working, and all of a sudden some little gimmick shows that they're wrong. And then we have to investigate the conditions under which this bishop change of color happened and gradually learn the new rule that explains it more deeply. Unlike the chess game, though, in the case of the chess game, the rules become more complicated as you go along. But in the physics, when you discover new things, it looks more simple. It appears on the whole to be more complicated because we learn about a greater experience. That is, we learn about more particles and new things. And so the laws look complicated again. But if you realize all the time what's kind of wonderful, it is as we expand our experience into wilder and wilder regions of experience, every once in a while we have these integrations in which everything is pulled together in a unification, which it turns out to be simpler than it looked before. But what I'm working on in physics right now is a special problem which we've come up against. You know that everything's made out of atoms. We've got that far already, and most people know that already. And that the atom has a nucleus with electrons going around. The behavior of the electrons on the outside, the laws for it are well understood as far as we can tell in this quantum electrodynamics that I told you about. And after that was evolved, then the problem was, how does the nucleus work? How are the particles interact? How do they hold together? One of the byproducts was to discover fission and to make a bomb. But in investigating the forces that hold the nuclear particles together, it was a long task. At first, it was thought that was an exchange of some sort of particles inside, which were invented by Yukawa, called pions. And it would be predicted that if you would hit protons against, the proton is one of the particles in the nucleus, against the nucleus, it would knock out such pions. And sure enough, such particles came out. Not only pions came out, but other particles, and we began to run out of names, kaons and sigmas and lambdas and so on. These are all called hadrons now. And as we increased the energy, the reaction got more and more different kinds until there were hundreds of different kinds of particles. Then the problem was, of course, during all this, this period is from 1950 up to the present, was to find the pattern behind it. And there seemed to be very many interesting patterns among the particles. Until a theory was evolved to explain these patterns, that all of these particles were really made of something else. That they were made of a thing called quarks. Three quarks, for example, would form a proton. Proton is one of the particles in the nucleus, another one is a neutron. The quarks came in a number of varieties. In fact, at first, only three were needed to explain all the hundreds of particles. And the different kinds of quarks, they were called U-type, D-type, S-type. Two U's and a D made a proton. Two D's and a U made a neutron. If they were moving in a different way inside, they were some other particle, and so on. Then the problem came, what is exactly the behavior of the quarks and what holds them together? And a theory was thought of, which is a very close analogy to quantum electrodynamics. Not exactly the same, but very close, in which the quarks are like the electron, and the photons which go between electrons, which makes them attract each other electrically, were called gluons. The mathematics was very similar, but it's a few terms slightly different. The difference in the form of the equations that were guessed at were guessed by principles, by such beauty and simplicity that it isn't arbitrary. It's very, very determined. Now, unlike electrodynamics, two electrons can be pulled apart as far as you want. In fact, when they're very far away, the force is weakened. If this were true and if these were made out of quarks, you would have expected that when you hit things together hard enough, the quarks would come out. But instead of that, when you do an experiment with enough energy that quarks could come out, instead of that, you found a big jet, that is all particles going about the same direction, of the old hadrons. No quark. And it was clear that what was required was that when the quark comes out, it kind of makes these new pairs of quarks and they come in little groups and make hadrons. The question is, why is it so different than electrodynamics? How do these small term different, these little terms that are different in the equation, produce such different effects, entirely different effects? In fact, it was very surprising to most people that this would really come out. At first, you would think the theory was wrong. But the more it's studied, the more clear it became that it's very possible that these extra terms would produce these effects. Now we're in a position that's different in history than any other time in physics. It's always different. We have a theory, a complete and definite theory of all of these hadrons, and we have an enormous number of experiments and lots of details. Now, why can't we test the theory right away to find out if it's right or wrong? Because what we have to do is calculate consequences of the theory. If this theory is right, what should happen? Well, this time, the difficulty is in the first step. If the theory is right, what should happen is very hard to figure out. The mathematics needed to figure out what the consequences of this theory are have turned out to be, at the present time, insuperably difficult, all right? And therefore, obvious what my problem is. My problem is to try to develop a way of getting numbers out of this theory, to test it. I spent a few years trying to invent mathematical things that would permit me to solve the equations, and I didn't get anywhere. And then I decided that in order to do that, I must first understand more or less how the answer probably looks. In other words, people didn't even understand roughly how it worked. And so I've been working most recently, the last year or two, on understanding roughly how it works, not quantitatively yet, with the hope that in the future, that rough understanding can be refined into a precise mathematical algorithm to get from the theory to the particles. You see, we're in a funny position. It's not that we're looking for the theory. We've got the theory. But we're in the step in science that we need to compare the theory to experiment by seeing what the consequences are and checking them. We're stuck in seeing what the consequences are. And it's my aim, it's my desire to work out what the consequences of this theory are. It's kind of a crazy position to be in, to have a theory that you can't work out the consequences of. I can't stand it. I have to figure it out.
The remarkable Dr. Richard Feynman. His books are still available, and the play QED at the Ensemble Theatre in Sydney is nearing the end of its run. Do try to catch it with Henry Zepps. Next week, another amazing American, Dr. Peter Bernhardt of St. Louis in Missouri, on how plants got their godlike names. Production by Kyla Slaven. I'm Robin Williams.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online. with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.